This is an Enterprise Time Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here in an exceptionally sunny San Francisco with NS1.
And Nate Lindstrom from NS1. Hey guys, yeah, it is a really nice day here. We've been having a lot of rain and now it's warm again. Perfect day for this.
Do you want to tell people a bit about what NS1 does?
We're an intelligent traffic routing solution and we use DNS to accomplish that. Your typical run-of-the-mill DNS is basically a phone book. You resolve a name to an IP, but it turns out if you resolve a name to an IP that best suits that user at that point in time, you can do all kinds of cool stuff with it.
Do you want to give us an example of that?
A really common use case is as soon as you spin up a second data center, or as soon as you go into, say, a second Amazon region or whatever, you now have this problem of, all right, where do you send a user? Do you want to just pick one at random, possibly route them across the country? Or do you want to do something intelligent and send them to the closest data center? So the minimum bar is geo-targeting. Send them to the closest. And then above and beyond that is something that's really becoming popular these days called RUM steering, or real user metric steering. And the idea is that you actually take a measurement to all of your endpoints and then choose the most performant one for that user.
Now, obviously with cloud, one of the challenges for companies is they've put their applications and some of their data up in the cloud. Users are connecting from anywhere. So this applies very much when we hear terms like latency and slow connections. It's improving the ability of people to work.
Definitely.
It's like that moment you turn your computer on and you sit and watch the little thing spin round, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. So people are spending less time waiting for a page to load, less time waiting for their upload to complete. And it affects also how much time you spend waiting for the connection to get set up, which is the most irritating time to wait because nothing is happening yet.
When we think of DNS from a security perspective, it's got quite a bad name over the last few years, not least last year when the Myra botnet decided to play nasty on the internet. What have companies got to start thinking about from a security perspective?
I think it's two things. So one is reliability. If no one can resolve your domain, then they can't get to your website. They can't even send you an email to tell you that the website is down. I mean, literally, they just walk away. And I've seen the numbers, especially if you're in the retail business. People have a very low tolerance for how long they'll wait. And generally, once they give up, they never come back. And worse, once they give up, they're very likely to tell their friends about their negative experience, and then their friends won't even try it. So reliability is huge. And then the other one is phishing and preventing it. Companies that are in the financial space like PayPal are extremely concerned by this because it's really, really easy to set up a website that looks just like PayPal or just like Wells Fargo. And then if you're able to get the user to go there, either because you have gotten them to not notice that the domain is wrong, or even better, you've managed to somehow hijack the legit domain and get the user to actually go to wellsfargo.com and then end up on the malicious site, then you can steal all kinds of personal information like their social security number and get access to their accounts. Reliability and authenticity, I think, are the two big concerns.
If we look at reliability first, it's not just about somebody taking over the internet or taking DNS down. Reliability is what causes so much problem for retailers, particularly around Black Friday and all these major shopping days. And that's because when they spin up multiple instances, they don't think about what the impact is on DNS. They don't have enough access in. They don't route the traffic properly. Why is it still such an issue? Because this isn't something new. This has been an issue with DNS 30 years now?
I think it's still an issue because DNS is at once both an extremely simple concept, it's basically a key value store, and at the same time, it has an arcane set of rules around what it has its own acronyms, it has its own terminology, and it tends to be something that gets set up, works usually on the first try, and then is forgotten about. And then when you either hit a scaling limitation with it, or you need to make some sort of change to it, inevitably the guy who set it up last touched it 2 years ago, and you go to make the change, and it's like, I don't understand what this is or why it's here or what it does. And then if it goes wrong in a spectacularly visible fashion, because usually all of a sudden no one can get to your sites anymore. The hottest trend right now is to outsource DNS. In other words, hardly anyone spins up their own bind servers anymore. Because of Amazon with Route 53 and Dyn and Ultra DNS and NS1, it's much easier to do a managed approach where you outsource it. And I think it's not a bad idea because it also means you've got people who know DNS really well that you can call and get help from.
But how do you stop customers then becoming disconnected from what's going on? We see this a lot around security at the moment. People don't have the staff. They don't have the skills. They think that outsourcing it to somebody else means it's no longer their problem. But actually, there's a whole bunch of things that are still your problem. You've still got to manage that outsourced provider. Are you seeing enough maturity in the market for customers where they're saying, okay, we'd like you to look after this, but tell us what you're doing, explain this? Or are they simply saying, for God's sake, take it away?
I would say a lot of it is actually the latter. They just want to throw it over the fence and hope it works. There are more savvy customers who understand that once you assign a key piece of your infrastructure to a vendor, you need to monitor it. And then often it becomes this interesting thing where they also outsource the monitoring to like a Catch Point or a Thousand Eyes or something like that. But that's a good way to go. If you're going to turn DNS over to somebody, you should keep an eye on it, especially for performance. It's relatively easy to monitor that your www record is resolving the way you expect. What's harder to tell is if it is resolving in a timely manner everywhere, worldwide. It may be fast in the US, but dog slow somewhere else, and you want to know about that.
That's a particular issue for companies who've got large mobile workforces globally, and can be an issue for them with data sovereignty, because they're not allowed to move data out of some countries. Germany, for example, has very strict data sovereignty rules. How do we begin to improve the quality of those connections?
Sort of a multi-layered thing. From just a pure DNS perspective, some providers allow you to do what we call fencing. So you can return a set of answers that are specific, say, to the EU, thereby at least taking a first stab at keeping the EU users within the EU and not allowing their data to leak out. But it's not enough just to do it with DNS, because people could be using a resolver that's outside of the EU. They could be spoofing their IP, whatever. You also need to do it at an application layer and actually enforcing some kind of user identity management and making sure that data is localized correctly. It is, I think, a matter of education, both educating the site reliability engineers, the DevOps guys, and those kind of guys to the importance of DNS and how it actually ties into a lot of systems where people don't necessarily think DNS plays a role. And then also at a high level, I think educating like the VPs and the CTOs and the CIOs, there is this thing out here called DNS. You absolutely depend on it. And it is worth making sure you at least understand and trust who is managing it.
How much of it gets architected in, though? Because if we go back to the early 90s, mid-90s, certainly the dot-com boom, we talked a lot about architecting our DNS to service the business requirements. These days, there doesn't seem to be any focus on that. The assumption is just that the internet is there, that DNS will work, that applications will perform. Is that a mistake? Do we need to take a step back and have somebody in the organization understand the architecture of the DNS as we're set up for our business? Or is that something that's just simply part of the outsourcing deal?
I think the former. I think you do need to understand how it fits into your business and fits into even functional units within the business. Taking what I call the bitbucket approach to any technology usually results in pain and suffering. It's like, well, it's just here, it's infinite, throw bits into it and it just works. Like, no. Maybe figure out who in the organization understands the flow of information between groups or business functions and clue them in on not only how the infrastructure structures set up, but also how DNS has been architected. They don't need to know DNS per se. It's more of they need to understand if a particular business unit is trying to resolve something, does the answer that they get make sense from the perspectives of how information is moving through the whole?
You talked about trustworthiness earlier. How engaged are security teams with understanding what's going on with DNS? Because thinking about it, if somebody creates a pay-pal.com account and an end user clicks on it from inside the enterprise, should it not be relatively simple for the security team to actually be looking for things like that, identify it, and stop the user going there way before something gets out of hand?
Agreed. It should be. The interesting thing is that while it should be simple, it turns out to not be a simple problem. And actually, OpenDNS has centered their business around this. Part of their whole claim to fame is that they block phishing sites through either returning a DNS answer or not. And even they will tell you it's not 100% accuracy. There's other things. I think that where the problem should be tackled on is both user education. Don't click links in emails. If you get an email, especially from your bank, saying all is lost, go to the bank's website, type in the URL, and visit it directly. Don't click on anything. Also, the security guys should make sure that the network teams and the developers and those guys are employing the technologies that are available to secure this kind of stuff. So I'm talking about like SPF and DKIM and DMARC, like things to authenticate the emails that are coming in and at least try to eliminate the phishing at the perimeter. And then once it's inside, I think your best defense is user education. If you are running your own caching DNS service, then maybe you can go down the path of trying to filter what responses you'll give out. But frankly, that's a really tough nut to crack.
Tough nut in what way?
You need to either go down the path of whitelisting all the sites you want your users to get to, which is an eternal list, and it will always have at least one user pissed off that their favorite site is not whitelisted. And then they seek ways to circumvent it. Like, I've worked at companies that had draconian site whitelisting kind of rules in place, and all my coworkers ever did was figuring out ways to get around it. Or you go down the path of blacklisting, and you can never keep ahead of the bad guys. You can never out-blacklist the bad guys. They just register domains in the thousands.
But if you look around, there's a lot of talk in the industry that we need to do more whitelisting. We need to do more blacklisting to be more secure. What you're saying is actually, it's a nice talking point, but practically it's impossible to keep on top of.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think it sounds good, but when you get into the practicalities of it, you're looking at almost having people whose full-time job it is to maintain your lists. It doesn't work. I think you're better off trying to educate people, making them a little bit paranoid. Well, a little bit of paranoia never hurt anybody. And then making sure you're leveraging the technologies that are out there to the greatest extent that you can.
When we talk about using DNS in that sort of way, one of the challenges is cloud services. Users bring their own technology in the office, they use their own cloud services, the enterprise has no clue what cloud services data is being sent to, because they don't have a process generally to start resolving regularly seen IP addresses to DNS to resolve that out to what service that might be. What role should the outsourcing companies play in this? Because again, if I look at your site, I look at some of your competitor sites, I don't see a service option there for my security teams that is looking at the traffic coming from inside my site and saying, hey, some of that's resolving to these places, which are perfectly secure and well-known places. Some of this is resolving to parts of the world where you probably don't want your users sending data. And some of this might be legitimate. You need to think about it. How do we close that gap? Because surely that's a critical piece of data for security.
It is. It's interesting. So there's sort of two groups of DNS providers. So there's the authoritative guys. They are responsible for answering queries directed at a domain for which they host the records. So NS1 is that. We're an authoritative provider. Another example of that is like Route 53 or Dyn. And then there's the caching guys, the guys who recursively go and get your answers. And they have incredible visibility into what your users are doing because they're going out and fetching all the answers for them. And so when you outsource that, it tends to be either to OpenDNS that does have some pretty good analytics around what your users are doing, or what's super common and is even happening in this shared co-working space office we're sitting in right now, is everybody just uses Google. Now, I'm sure Google is mining that information because it's fantastically valuable, but they're not feeding it back to you in a way that lets you make any sort of security decisions off of it. I would argue that if you want to see where your users are going, especially in a bring-your-own-device environment, and then maybe start to restrict that, maybe you have a policy saying you can't use Dropbox, then you almost certainly have to run your own recursive resolver. And so not only can you get the stats out of it to see where people are going, but then you can also at some point start to put rules into it. And that means you need at least a person who understands DNS pretty well.
Why should companies have to still do that themselves? I mean, we live in an as-a-service environment. Companies now are outsourcing almost everything they've got into cloud. Some are keeping some things inside, but if we look at the mid to small market, it's about dump the whole lot off, get somebody else to take responsibility because we can't afford the staff to do a lot of this. Is there a space where this starts to become a proper as a service, maybe driven by a security vendor, but surely it should be driven by the whole DNS industry?
Yeah, actually, I think I agree. I think there may be a space for this. The interesting thing is that one attitude that I've commonly seen with companies that decide to go into the cloud is they go all in without a lot of consideration for security. And somebody might come along and be like, well, I keep my files on Dropbox. And the next employee, well, I keep my files on Box. And the next employee is like, I keep it in Google Drive. And at some point, people are just like, well, it's in the cloud. What do we care? And so it's scattered all over. I have been at companies where we have made an attempt to say, nope, everybody has to use Google Drive, for example. And then at some point you hit some edge case, usually with permissions or something, and the next thing you know, people are using Google Drive and Dropbox. They just don't talk about it. And so it's a problem that I think remains to be solved, and it's certainly not a problem that's going to be solved anytime soon, nor is it being helped with the attitude of if it's in the cloud, it's somehow magically secure and reliable because it's, I don't know, in the cloud.
You talked earlier about it's impossible to keep up with the way the bad guys use DNS, and we see that. We've got a whole bunch of apps out there at the moment on the dark web that every time we see a major attack, these things are generating new DNS addresses on a daily basis. They're generating new domains almost by the hour. I don't mean one or two, I mean hundreds with some of these attacks. Yeah. How hard is it to assist customers in staying away from this or spotting this as a particular risk? And how do we apply a more authenticative approach to say, these domains have only just appeared, should we be trusting them?
I know some companies are actually taking that last approach where they're looking at the age of the domain, but to the most part, it's still, I sense, under discussion. We haven't quite nailed down how best to do that. I know that there are some filtering apps out there that will actually look at how long a .com domain has been registered and sort of graylist it for a period of time. It has to be around for like a month before we'll actually let users go to it, kind of thing. But this is one of these things where I think only recently have people outside of the security industry begun to realize just how many domains there are and how fast they're being registered, how many lookalike domains there are, especially for the PayPals of the world.
Where does threat intelligence play into the sort of things you offer? Because threat intelligence is gathering a lot of this stuff. It brings it together. Do you feed that in regularly to start looking at what's being created and what you need to block, what you should be avoiding? Or is that still something that, again, being security versus network, there's still a gap between that level of communication?
It's closing. There's still a little bit of a gap. At NS1, we actually do incorporate threat intelligence to look at not so much what our internal users are doing, but more of looking at domain registrations for hosting, because we offer a free tier level of service for hosting, and anytime you have a free service, the bad guys like to exploit it. I mean, the bad guys want fast, reliable DNS as much as the good guys, but there's still a gap. I see a lot of companies that offer threat intelligence, and I see people that are consuming it kind of in piecemeal, oftentimes more around fraud prevention in website form submittal. That's like a huge thing. But it's starting to spread into other areas where it's not just about, is the address information and the credit card that was submitted, is it legit or is it coming from an abuser or something? It's starting to finally incorporate looking at email authenticity, which depends heavily on DNS. And I think at some point, it hasn't gotten there yet, but at some point I think it will start to incorporate DNS and DNSSEC into it. And maybe at some point it'll get to be where I would love to see a day, I don't know that it'll happen, but I would love to see a day where you could tell your users it's generally safe to click on a link in an email.
Wow, wouldn't that be a day?
Yeah.
That issue of links in email, one of the problems is that they're often very heavily obfuscated as to what they are. Users don't right-click and look at it first. They just click on what appears to be there. What tools can we start to put inside enterprises so that when those emails come in, when the user sees it, actually, that email can have some form of reputation attached to it, e.g., there's an IP address, a link in here, and we're going to color that red because we're not sure we've gone and done a security check. It will slow down the flow of emails at some point, but, you know, technology will speed that up over time. Is that something we could realistically start to look at doing to improve security?
So it's funny that you ask about that and coloring links and all that, because almost 14 years ago, I was running a patch version of Qmail for a company where I was stripping all the links out of incoming emails just to sidestep the whole problem. Like, you would get an email and it would say, click here, and they'd be like, oh, when I click there, nothing happens. It's like, yes, I removed the URL. It's like, go to the website directly. So the sort of reputation-based leaving the link in, taking it out, the technology to do that's there. It's been there for years. I'm not sure why anybody is not doing it. Maybe it goes back to the whole, you need some sort of reliable reputation feed in the first place. Otherwise, you're back to whitelisting and blacklisting again, and then you're just applying it to email links. I almost feel like the most reliable state of the art right now is to encourage people not to click on links, and then just make sure that you're supplying them with reliable DNS, so when they type the URL in directly, it works, and they get to where they're trying to go.
The effectiveness of the Myra bot last year, I think, shocked the whole industry. I don't think anybody, until that point, had really considered how one single botnet could have such an impact on DNS. A lot of work's been done since to try and overcome that, but if we look at what we're starting to see from IoT attacks and the building of new IoT botnets, these botnets have some significant capability likely to hit us very shortly, not least because of their ability to swamp everything. What steps do A, the industry need to take to improve, but from an enterprise perspective, what do they need to have in mind to make sure that they don't become the next set of victims?
For the DNS industry, it is largely an arms race right now. We need more bandwidth. We need enough capacity that we can swallow, realistically, a 2 terabit attack, because that's coming. We also do a lot of intelligent filtering at many, many stages to make sure that the traffic that ultimately we're responding to is legitimate traffic. But filtering is also an arms race, because the better you get at filtering, the more the botnet evolves at sidestepping it. So it's an arms race. It's never going to end. And so on the enterprise side, what it boils down to is you need redundancy, plain and simple. You need two sets of name servers that are running on two completely separate networks so that if one of them is being taken down or is successfully taken down by an attack, your domain stays up because your other set of name servers remains online. And that presents a whole lot of challenges that are actually more a time sink for developers than anything else. So if you have two separate providers, let's say, and all you're doing is plain vanilla DNS, you're just resolving records to one answer, then it's super easy. You can do that just with AXFR, which is the native transport mechanism for replicating a domain from a master to a slave server. If you're an enterprise and you're doing any kind of intelligent routing using DNS, geo-targeting, geo-fencing, RUM-based steering that I mentioned earlier, now you face this problem where that old AXFR mechanism that has been around for a long time doesn't work. It doesn't have an understanding of intelligent records. And so what we see is the larger enterprises that have the resources for this, like LinkedIn, have written their own middleware that manages two different DNS providers by calling their APIs. And so the way, for example, LinkedIn makes a record change is they go into their own LinkedIn DNS portal, they make the change, and their portal calls our API, and it calls Dyn's API, and thereby keeping them in sync. Other companies that I won't name because their approach is more error-prone, they just take the approach of having a human try to remember to make the change in two places. And that works for a while, and then eventually it stops working. And another approach that's kind of unique is we have the ability to actually provision a dedicated network for a customer. And so Yelp, for example, takes advantage of this, where they're on both our cloud offering and they have their own dedicated network. And the idea being that if we have an issue and our cloud offering has a problem, Yelp is unaffected because their dedicated network covers for us. And we actually have seen this tested by trial of fire because of large DDoSes that we've encountered, and it's worked really, really well. The takeaway message is you have to have two sets of DNS being provided. At the end of the day, if you get attacked, if the enterprise itself is the target and they go after you on a DNS level, kind of layer four, layer three, depending on who you talk to, then you have a better chance of weathering it because now you have two different sets of networks, two different sets of filtering, two different sets of mitigation technology in play. And if it's a layer seven attack, then DNS probably won't be affected at all. And then it's down to how robust your web servers are. Are you using like a Cloudflare or something sitting in front of it to do the filtering?
One of the challenges of DDoS, as we've seen over the last few years, is it's increasingly becoming a distraction attack. Companies are so busy rushing around trying to get back online, bring things up, they take all their resources away from other places.
Yep, that was used against Sony exactly in that way, as a smokescreen.
What level of education do we need to get into IT security teams so that when they see these attacks, they actually don't become like Labradors chasing a tennis ball? They actually stay on point looking for what's happening.
A great analogy is there's a series of novels, the John Rain series. It's about this assassin. And one thing that I remember clearly from reading the series was when he would encounter someone unexpected, like he ran into an ex-girlfriend who he hadn't seen for a long time, standing in front of an elevator, the first thing he did was he turned around and he looked behind him because he just assumed it was a distraction that was being set up so he could be ambushed. It's like he was that kind of a person because he killed people for a living. So I guess that brings a certain level of paranoia. But the lesson is really valuable, which is if you perceive that you are getting hit in a particular way, assume until proven otherwise that it's a smokescreen or it's a distraction, especially if it's highly visible like a DDoS attack. Hack or penetration attacks tend to be much more quiet because they want to get in quietly and exfiltrate your data and not be detected. And even better, if the attacker can be in the systems for a long period of time, they have the possibility of stealing more stuff. Highly visible things like a DDoS should actually really be treated as a smokescreen because they are certainly used as a stick to beat companies when somebody has like a disagreement with them. Frankly, the Mirai botnet attack against Dyn was most likely a disgruntled gamer who was pissed off with the PlayStation Network, and Dyn was the target because of technology, but not the actual target in terms of the animosity. Earlier than that, even Sony had also been hit directly with a DDoS back before they used Dyn, and it was a smokescreen so that they could be penetrated. And this was Sony corporate as opposed to PlayStation Network. Don't pull everybody off and stick them on the DDoS when the DDoS is going on. Instead, have some people who are experts perhaps in DDoS, or you're talking to the DDoS mitigation vendor, but be looking at everything else. That's always the thing. Be vigilant throughout the DDoS. And be vigilant afterwards, because the attacker may have only paid for an hour of DDoS just as his initial setup, but he's actually planning to spend the next week trying to get in or something.
And that's part of the scary thing about this, isn't it? They're buying it for 10 minutes here, an hour there, 3 hours over there. It's so easy for them to acquire that. Taking that into account, I know it's hard to look forward as much as a week in this industry, but over the next year, what do you see as being the major challenges around DNS?
The first main challenge around DNS is going to be the size of the DDoSes that we're going to be facing. You know, everyone was kind of surprised when the DynaTAC broke the 1 terabit mark. And now that that's been broken, I think we're headed rapidly towards the 1.5 and then the 2 terabit mark. Because the future of botnets seems to lie in the IoT space, and the IoT space is exploding, and nobody's doing anything about security on IoT devices, really, I think the botnets are going to become larger and more powerful. And so the table stakes now for DNS providers, as we're seeing here at NS1, is that we have to have a ridiculous amount of capacity and bandwidth, like the kind of capacity and bandwidth that usually DDoS mitigation companies need, because it turns out now we're all our own DDoS mitigation provider. And then another thing is educating our customers and our contacts on how to configure DNS for resilience, because no matter how much bandwidth and capacity we might have, there's always going to be some idiot with a larger loaded gun at some point, and we might be saying, well, we're ready for the 2 terabit attack, and somebody figures out how to do a 3 terabit attack. And so it's as much about preparing as it is educating customers and helping them prepare.
The one thing we haven't seen is a DDoS attack at a specific nation to take down an entire country yet. Certainly not in terms of the larger countries, and those that have been aimed at smaller countries have really been about large business or something in that country where they've overwhelmed poor network links. How far away are we from that level of cyber warfare?
I think we're not far away from it at all. We've seen it on a very small scale a few years back, where it was believed that Russia DDoSed one of their former member states. However, you don't DDoS a state. You DDoS their new parliament and their website and whatever. China has gone after Hong Kong on at least one occasion. And then, of course, China went after GitHub because they didn't like something they were hosting. I think the challenge is and always will be identifying, if you're going to go after a country or a state, what about them are you going to go after? It's interesting that what hasn't really been attacked much yet, but as time goes on, I think it's going to become more and more of a viable target, is really pedestrian but critical things like utilities. If you think about it, right now we're sort of in this semi-state where things like paying your electrical bill and seeing your electricity usage has gotten better in terms of having an online portal and being able to look at it, but it's not completely online, it's not completely in the cloud or anything yet. Over time, though, that's going to happen, and the more that utilities like electricity and water and that kind of thing go online, then the more they can become a target. And if you are able to successfully either penetrate and take down or DDoS, say, the utility company, then you have a chance of really affecting a whole huge region, maybe an entire country, maybe an entire state.
Are any countries at this point in time capable of protecting critical national infrastructure from a DDoS attack?
I don't think so, other than through the age of the infrastructure. If it's not online at all, you can't DDoS it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this.